You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
What's going on, everybody? A Sunday morning, the 6th day of September 2020. Dan Grasso sitting in for Anita here on 98.7 ESPN. A little too easy for me. We got to ramp this thing up here over the course of the next few hours at 800-919-3776. Islander fans not feeling easy this morning. They might not even have gone to sleep yet, considering their team is one of the final four still left playing hockey up there north of the border. They're going to head to Edmonton for the Eastern Conference Finals. And congratulations to Islander Nation. We'll spend plenty of time talking about them here over the course of this program. You can find me on Twitter, as always, at Dan Grasso, G-R-A-C-A. Nikki Hartman, Giselle Hernandez at the controls, producing the program today as well. And you know, hope you guys are having a good holiday weekend, if it even feels like a holiday to a lot of you. You know, when you've been stuck at home for as long as we have, most of us have here with the quarantine. I don't know if days feel any different from one another, weeks feel any different, but alas, here we are. It is September, and if you really want to put it in perspective, this is going to be the last Sunday without football for the foreseeable future, and I, for one, cannot be happy. 1 week from today, Greg Buttle, myself, cast of thousands, Jets countdown to kickoff, Jets and Buffalo Bills, the season opener up there in Orchard Park. So we look forward to that and bringing you all of our outstanding Jets coverage over the course of the season. Giants, of course, will open a week from tomorrow at home against the Pittsburgh Steelers on Monday night. We'll talk to Pat Leonard from the Daily News, covers Big Blue, a little bit later on in the program. And we'll talk to my pal Ian Begley from SNY, Basketball Insider, about the big move the Nets make earlier in the week, tapping Steve Nash. That's right, Steve Nash to be the new head coach of that basketball team. So plenty of stuff to get into here over the next few hours here on a jam-packed Sunday morning. And we got to start with the hockey, right? Because, you know, really, credit to the New York Islanders for the way they've gone about their business here over the last couple of months. And I know that the bubble presents challenges, and I know that it hasn't been easy, but really just a full credit from the top all the way down, Lou Lamoriello, Barry Trotz, on down to the players. And I know that if you're an Islander fan, you were sweating things out the last few days, right? Because up 3-1, you're thinking that, all right, we got this thing in the bag. No worries, no concern. Series is ours. And then you have that little hiccup in game number 5, you lose in overtime. All right, no problem. We're still in good shape, up 3-2. We'll get them in game number 6. Then it's deja vu again. Not just overtime, but double overtime. And now you get pushed to a game 7. The two words that most fans don't want anything to do with it if it involves your team. And especially in the Islanders' case, who had this thing in their hands, in their control, and didn't even want to think about getting pushed to the limits, but they did. And then as soon as they dropped the puck last night, the Islanders were in complete control of that game. They seized the momentum right from the jump. And the Flyers, look, I understand the Islanders had a lot to do with it, but the Flyers looked like they wanted no part of that hockey game last night. I mean, you talk about the effort. You talk about the urgency. You didn't get any of that last night from Philadelphia. And again, full credit to the Islanders for completely just zapping that from them. But, I mean, if you're Philadelphia, you work this hard just to force a game number 7. You can at least maybe try to make it seem as if you want to win the game. But I didn't get that indication at all from them last night whatsoever. And Barry Trotz, once again, pushing all the right buttons, decided to make the change in goal, which I fully agreed with. You know, they needed to do something. Just sometimes making a change for the sense of making a change or the sake of making a change can pay dividends for you. And that's what happened last night with Thomas Greiss. Got the start in net, but credit to the guys in front of him. He wasn't even really tested that much, only having to turn aside 16 shots. I mean, when you think about through 40 minutes last night, Philadelphia only had 9 shots on goal. 9. So the Islanders played their system to a T. They clamped down. Not a heck of a lot of open ice for Philadelphia to work with. And then when Greiss had to make saves, he made saves. But in that first period, they got those 2 goals. Scotty Mayfield, good redemption from him. You know, he said there was a couple of sleepless nights for him after the broken stick contributed to Philadelphia having the rush the other day in game number 6, contributing to that winner. And then you had Andy Green, the longtime New Jersey Devil, a trade deadline acquisition by Lou Lamoriello, one of his former guys, as I said, in Jersey, making a contribution on a beautiful feed from a former Ranger, Derek Brassard, where he completely froze Connor Hart, and Green had the easy tap in there. And, you know, Philadelphia taking a couple of lazy penalties in that first period. Everything kind of just came together, and you had to feel good if you were an Islander fan. Even after that first period, you're like, all right, it might not be over yet. We still got a lot of work to do. But I like the way things are trending because, you know, it looked like, as I said, Philadelphia just didn't want any part of that game. And then when Brock Nelson scored the goal midway through the second period, starting the play with a beautiful steal on the back check and then turning it into offense, that's exactly what you want to see. I thought for sure after two periods, the game was over. Game was over. You know, after that second period, you could have actually taken the remote control, flipped around, maybe checked in on what the Yankees were doing down in Baltimore, seeing Gerrit Cole struggle against the O's. Yeah, I know that he had a lot of strikeouts and he mowed through the lineup first time through the order, but you know what? It's the box score and the final score that counts here, and we'll get into the Yankees stuff a little bit later on. He could have even checked in on the Mets, seen what was going on. Maybe if college football, the one or two games that were being played last night, if that floats your boat, but Islander fans, you could have put your feet up for those final 20 minutes. And what could have been better for that? And really, just, you got to be thrilled. And the only thing that you're left sitting here with in terms of regrets, if you're an Islander fan, is why couldn't this be played here, right? Why couldn't these games be played closer to home? And I know the game seven last night, if you know you want to go by a conventional playoff series, Philadelphia had the home ice advantage, so it would have been played in their rink. But maybe it wasn't even gotten to a game seven. You know, if that game was, you know, at the Coliseum or in Brooklyn or whatnot, game six, for example, maybe the Islanders finish it in six. Who knows? But now you're going to be playing the Eastern Conference Finals, and yes, it's going to go up to Edmonton. So they get to change venue in a way because they've been stuck in Toronto for the last several weeks. So at least for them, there's maybe a little bit of novelty there. They get into a different hotel. You're going to be playing in a different rink, so maybe that part will feel differently. But you're still not going to get that same rush as if these games were being played here at home. You know, and that's the one thing you're left lacking. And you hear everybody talk about, well, the Islanders in the Eastern Conference Finals, first time in 27 years since 1993. If you want to be a real stickler, okay, 1993, there wasn't even such a thing as the Eastern Conference Finals, Western Conference Finals. They were still the Wales Conference and the Campbell Conference. So technically, this is the Islanders' first time in the Eastern Conference Finals. But if you're a fan, you will take it regardless. You don't care less what they call it. Bottom line is that there's four teams still playing hockey, and your team is one of them. And nothing, absolutely nothing could be better than that. And really, it's a testament to how fundamentally sound and how fundamentally well set up this organization is. And as I said, it starts from the top with Lou Lamoriello, proven winner, proven architect, Hall of Famer for what he did for two decades plus with the New Jersey Devils, making them a three-time Stanley Cup champion. Barry Trotz, who was a good coach in this league for a long time. You know, maybe people in this neck of the woods didn't really follow his exploits all those years with the Nashville Predators, but Barry Trotz took an expansion team in Nashville from scratch, from the ground up, and slowly but surely made them into what became a perennial playoff team in the Western Conference. But Barry Trotz was then labeled one of those guys, despite having a long, long range of success there in Nashville, but he was labeled as one of those guys that, you know, couldn't win once the playoffs got around. You know, he had a hard time winning a series with the Nashville Predators. Forget about going to conference finals. He couldn't even get through the first round. And then they ended up parting ways after a while, and he hooked on with the Washington Capitals. And then in a few years had them as Stanley Cup champions, slaying the Dragon, helping Alex Ovechkin now finally have Stanley Cup champion next to his name. And I know that that has rubbed off here with the New York Islanders. So you had Lou, who knows everything there is to know about winning. You have Barry Trotz, who is a now proven Stanley Cup playoff head coach. And a guy, you know, we talk about players a lot, reversing trends in their careers. That's exactly what Barry Trotz did. You know, he reversed that label as a guy who couldn't win in the playoffs to now you think of him as being a big-time postseason coach. You know, it took him 19 years just to get to a conference finals from when he began his coaching career. And now here he is back again with another organization. And it's funny, too, because in the second round of the playoffs there, you had the Islanders who went up 3-1. You had Vegas who went up 3-1. You had Dallas go up 3-1 on the Colorado Avalanche. And all three of those teams got pushed to a Game 7, and all three of them collected themselves and ended up getting the job done in the winner take all. And now those three teams, along with the Tampa Bay Lightning, make up the Final Four in the National Hockey League. If you're an Islander fan, you got to be giddy. You know, if you're old enough to remember the dynasty, the four straight Stanley Cups there in the early 80s, it's been a long time between drinks, is it not? It's been a very, very long time. So this has got to taste extremely sweet for you. And you know what? If you weren't old enough to remember those glory years back in the day, you've had to wait long enough as it is. So I say congratulations to you. And I wish these games were closer to home, as I said, that you know, were able to pack the barn, to make noise, to cheer, all that stuff. But you'll take it. And they'll hear you from all the way up there in Edmonton. But it's not going to be easy against the Tampa Bay Lightning. This is the rhythm of the night. Baby, tonight's like fuego. We about to spend a dinero. Dan Grasso with you here on 98.7 ESPN on a beautiful Sunday morning. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Grasso, G-R-A-C-A. It's time for a little Diamond Notes, which is brought to you by Garden State Community Bank, a division of New York Community Bank. And Mike Trout, best player in baseball, right, hit his 300th career home run in the first game of a doubleheader against the Houston Astros on Saturday. Passed Tim Salmon for the most in Angels franchise history, and he's only 29 years old. Trout came into the game with 201 career stolen bases, became the fastest to 300 home runs and 200 stolen bases. Trout did it in just 1,235 games. Willie Mays, now the second fastest all-time to the mark, did it in 1295. Trout becomes the 151st member of the 300 Home Run Club and just the 16th to reach the mark before turning 30 years old. That's Diamond Notes brought to you by Garden State Community Bank, a division of New York Community Bank, serving our community since 1859. Visit mynycb.com for details. Funny thing happened on the second game of that doubleheader that I was watching last night between the Angels and the Astros, because, you know, like we see it here with the local teams, right? The Mets and the Yankees have had to play a bunch of doubleheaders, and, you know, they split the doubleheaders, and sometimes one team is the home team for one game and the other is the home team for the second game. And you kind of like lose your train of thinking a little bit because they're playing in the other team's home ballpark, but yet the visitor is the home team. You get what I'm saying. Like when the Mets beat the Yankees on the walk-off at Yankee Stadium, what was it, last Friday, I guess, when Rosario hit the walk-off home run, like it didn't even register to me that that was the end of the game, because you figure, well, it's in Yankee Stadium. It's a Yankee home game, and you had to be reminded that, no, the Mets were the home team. Same thing happened last night in the Angels game, because top of the seventh inning in the nightcap, Anthony Rendon hit a three-run home run, and Victor Rojas, who's the television play-by-play guy for the Angels, he called it a walk-off, and then as Rendon is rounding the bases, I guess he remembered that, no, it's the Astros who are the home team for the second game of the doubleheader. So it was kind of funny, but that's 2020 baseball for you and all the things that we've had to get used to and we're going to have to continue to get used to. What Yankee fans don't want to get used to is Gerrit Cole not going out there and dominating, or at least resembling a $324 million pitcher like the Yankees thought they were getting when they cut him that big fat check in the offseason. And I'll say this, okay? I'm not going to try to come on here and tell you that Gerrit Cole has been bad or that Gerrit Cole has been a bust. I'm not going that far, because that's just not true. Gerrit Cole has been good to very good. He just hasn't been great. And when you pay a guy $324 million, you need him to be great. And will that happen between now and the end of the season if you're the New York Yankees? Well, you hope so. But it's not like he's going anywhere because he's going to be wearing pinstripes for a very, very long time. And I know that this year is quirky, and you could just chalk it up as well. It's an abbreviated season anyway. Things are all out of sorts. I'm not too concerned. Well, all right, he could take that approach, but remember, the Yankees got Gerrit Cole to be their stopper, to be that one proven commodity in their starting rotation to be able to stop the bleeding in a big situation, whether it's a losing streak. And if you get to the playoffs, the guy who you're going to be able to give the baseball to, and you know that if you're a member of that bullpen, that you're not going to really have to do much that night because this guy's going to pitch you deep into a ball game. Are you confident that's going to happen now? Are you confident the Yankees are even going to make the playoffs? You know, let's get into that question. Right now, you're 21 up and 18 down. Okay, you got 3 weeks left in the season. How scary is that? That 3 weeks from today, the regular season is over. You're talking about flying by. Now, I know that it's a short season anyway, but I mean, it really has flown by. So you got a third of the season left right now. And if you take stock of the New York Yankees after 40 games, you know, let's ask ourselves, what is this baseball team? What are they? Are they the prohibitive favorite in the American League that we all assumed that they were going to be way back at the beginning? Remember that Dodgers-Yankees collision course to the World Series that everybody was talking about, or at least I thought was going to happen too? The Dodgers are doing their part. You know, they're the only team in Major League Baseball right now with 30 wins. Yankees, shoot. How can you sit here and say the Yankees look like a favorite to get to the World Series? All the things that we thought were going to happen for this team, the things that we maybe took for granted, are few and far between. Injuries have cropped up yet again, which they might have like a voodoo situation going on, you know, in the Bronx. I don't know what's happening. Did they hire like Ray Ramirez, the old Mets trainer? Remember when they had like 50 guys on the injured list every other day, it seemed like? You know, the Yankees just can't seem to get out of their way when it comes to staying healthy. You thought that Gerrit Cole was going to go out there and dominate. He is not. Plus, you have other guys down for the count in the starting rotation, led by, you know, James Paxton, who you don't know what the heck you're going to get from him the rest of the way. You know, you thought the lineup was going to score a bunch of runs. Hasn't happened. You thought the bullpen was going to be a strength to go with now what you had hoped was an improved starting rotation. And now you've started to see some cracks from that contingent. You know, and it's not like you look at the Yankee bullpen and you say to yourself, boy, you know, they're missing a lot of key guys. You know, that injury bug has really wreaked havoc in that relief corps. No, it hasn't. It's just guys not doing their job. And you don't want to get into the same old routine of having to rely on those guys as much as you ordinarily would. That's the problem the Yankees got into last year and why things ultimately fell apart for them against the Houston Astros in the playoffs. I know you could say, well, they didn't hit, they didn't score enough runs. Well, yeah, that's true, but then they also kind of put so much of a burden on the bullpen that if they did have the least bit of a slip-up, it was going to be in a costly situation, and that also contributed to their exit in the playoffs. So 20 games left in the season, what are they? And they're trending in a complete opposite direction as you would hope at this stage of the game. Look, they're going to make the playoffs. They'll get into the postseason because if you look at the American League right now, it's littered with the haves and the have-nots. Because there's seven teams right now in the American League that are done. All right, I've seen enough to tell you they're not making the playoffs. Baltimore, Boston, Detroit, Kansas City, Seattle, Angels, Texas. That's seven right there. So if you do some simple math, seven from 15, there's eight left. And those are going to be the eight teams that get into the playoffs. The question for the Yankees is, where are they going to fit in? Right now, can I sit here and tell you with certainty that they're going to be able to collect themselves and overtake Tampa and get to the top of the American League East again? No. I don't think they're winning the division. You know, Tampa, to me, has proven to be the best team in this AL East, and they've got a laundry list of injuries, especially on their pitching staff. But they're not using that as an excuse. They're going out there and getting the job done. You know, and you can say, oh, well, you know, it's okay. You know, it's going to happen. It's weird. It's a 60-game season. No. No. This was World Series or bust for the New York Yankees this year. I don't care that there was only 60 games. It's World Series or bust. So you're darn right that there's going to be disappointment. And you know what? There might be some consequences if this team underachieves. You know, you're not just going to be able to get to October this year like you do in every other season and fortunately get lined up against the Minnesota Twins and beat their brains in. That might not happen. And, you know, I was keyed in on the Islanders last night. So I wasn't with the Yankee game for the first 5-6 innings when Cole was in there. You know, you follow along on Twitter and social media and whatnot. And if you didn't know any better, and I was in this boat. If you didn't know any better, and you just followed Twitter and read that and social media and everything, you would have thought that Gerrit Cole was, you know, pitching a perfect game, mowing people down left and right. Yankees had a comfortable lead. They were going to cruise to a victory, start another winning streak against the Baltimore Orioles, and all was going to be right with the world. Well, then I finally switch over a little bit later on, and I see that they're trailing. I see that Cole's out of the game, Cole's struggling. It's like, well, what the heck happened? And you can't take that approach either. You know, I don't care how many guys that Gerrit Cole strikes out. Show me the end result. I don't care what he did against this batting order the first time through it. And he was mowing him down. You lost the game. And then he ran into trouble in that one inning. And I understand you had the throwing error by Tyro Estrada. I get it. I get all those things. But you know what? If you're an ace, if you are a guy that's supposed to be considered one of the best pitchers in baseball, then make a pitch. Make a pitch to stop the bleeding. You know, sometimes the guys with the gloves behind the pitchers, sometimes they make plays to pick up the pitcher, to bail him out. The pitcher can do that too. And especially if you're that well thought of like Gerrit Cole, you know what, you could do that on occasion as well. He still walked a couple of guys in that inning. That's got nothing to do with his defense. Make a pitch. Striking guys out left and right, like I said, the first few innings, where was some of that there when he needed it? You know, you realize Gerrit Cole's got an ERA this year, which is a half run higher than David Peterson, the rookie from the Mets, who nothing was expected from him at the beginning of the season. You didn't even think he was going to be on the team. This is not what the Yankees paid for. He's only gotten through 7 innings once. One time. Yankees aren't paying $320 million for a 6-inning pitcher. Now, granted, you could validate all that stuff, and everything I'm saying can go out the window if he goes out there in October and pitches the Yankees to a World Series. But right now, from what you're seeing, from Cole, from this lineup who couldn't get a timely clutch hit to save their lives, and everything else with this baseball team, even some of the quirky decisions by this manager, which really make you scratch your head at times. All these things taken into consideration, are you confident right now that this Yankee team is going to be trademarked for the World Series? I'm not. Not me. And forget about Cole. The only other guy you have even somewhat of confidence in this rotation is Tanaka. So it's kind of like you're in the same situation you were in last year. But worse. Right? Last year you had Tanaka, you got Paxton, and then a strong bullpen. This year, you got Cole, you got Tanaka. You know, you think on their best day the bullpen will be okay, but you can't be really sure. You got a lineup which is littered with injuries. And you know what? I understand that guy, you know, Judge isn't around, Stanton isn't around, I get that. But what about the guys who are still there? You mean to tell me you can't win and you can't produce with some of the names that are still in this batting order? Hicks, Sanchez, again, I could strike out Gary Sanchez right now. And I've defended him over the years. You know, I've defended the guy. But this is just laughable right now. You know, Gleyber Torres, I thought he was going to be the American League MVP at the beginning of the season. He's been awful. Awful. I know he's just coming back from injury, but still, he's been awful. He was awful before he went down. Gardner's been bad. You know, everybody was taking bows with the Yankees with this depth that they had last year. When they had the injuries and you had the Fords and the Tuchmans and the Urshelas and all these guys elevate their games and they didn't miss a beat. And oh, what a great organization they are. Where are those guys this year? Where's that incredible depth this time around? I can't find it. Playing with fire one too many times. That's what you're doing. And if you look at their schedule here in the month of September, what they have left, they still haven't even played the Blue Jays yet. And that Blue Jays team made moves at the trade deadline. They brought in a bunch of pitching. Bichette is going to be back here in the next couple of weeks, they hope. Yankees are going to forget about Tampa Bay. Yankees are going to have to fend off Toronto just to nail down second place. so they can guarantee themselves a spot in the playoffs. And they're going to play all 10 games against the Blue Jays here in the next few weeks. You got Baltimore, who's still not any good. You got Boston, who's still not any good. And then you have a Marlins team, which, you know, give Don Mattingly and company credit. They've played hard this year. But you're going to play 21 games, and you only have one off day the rest of the season. One off day with a beaten-up, battered group. Yanks not trending in the right direction. Dan Crosser back with you here on 98.7 ESPN. NFL season a week away. Jets will be up in Buffalo. Giants open at home on Monday Night Football under the lights. They'll take on the Pittsburgh Steelers, and one of the guys who will be there, as well as with the team every step of the way, is Pat Leonard, who covers Big Blue for the New York Daily News. He's nice enough to give me a couple of minutes here on a Sunday morning. Pat, long time no chat. Dan Grasso, how are you, my friend?
Dan, I'm doing great. I've actually been watching a lot of hockey lately. That Islanders-Flyers series was something. I know I'm on the football beat now, but I always got that hockey bug in me, so it's been fun to watch.
Hockey never leaves your blood, definitely not. And, you know, we're sitting here talking about the Islanders in the conference finals in the first week of September, no doubt. This just goes to show you how crazy 2020 is. But first training camp under Joe Judge has now come and gone. Did you have to run any penalty laps?
You know what? I'm surprised he didn't walk over and tell me to drop him 20 or something. That's certainly the tone of Judge's camp was new. It was different. It was hard-nosed. It was something that caught a lot of people off guard at first. But you know, I will say this, as alarming as especially that one one-on-one drill was, and that's something you ask people around the league, yeah, maybe the Patriots do it, but hasn't been done at the Giants in a long time, and most teams do not do stuff like that. But the thing is, you know, the question has always been throughout this, is a Judge being authentic? Is he being himself, or is he trying to be somebody else? And at least my read from being there every day and from trying to get to know him a little bit and know the program and the staff is this is who he is. You know, he doesn't think he can be Bill Belichick. I mean, Judge is just somebody who from day one, growing up in football and you know, as a player and as an assistant, he has developed this detailed, you know, nose to the grindstone, doesn't mind working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week kind of deal. And that is who he is, and that's what he wants the team to be.
Yeah, I know that ultimately he's going to be measured, as all coaches are, by wins and losses, right? That's going to be the ultimate determination as to whether he's successful or he's not. But so far, and they haven't played a game yet, shoot, they didn't even have a preseason game, but just in terms of the training camp, his demeanor, his tone, the way the players take to him, is there something that stands out from Joe Judge as opposed to what you witnessed the last couple of years under, let's say, Pat Shurmur?
No question. I think the number one thing that comes to my mind is him chewing out Saquon Barkley very early in training camp over pretty much just he wanted a different pace to the installation of a play that they were doing, and he wanted everyone to pick it up a little bit, and everyone did, I guess, except Barkley in his mind. And the reason that's important is because, you know, to get buy-in, of course, if you don't have your star player buy-in, you don't have anybody's in the long run. And also comparing it to how coaches did here over the last couple of years, you know, one of the common internal criticisms of Shurmur and that staff is that basically, you know, sometimes they treated stars like stars. Maybe they'd be willing to yell at a player who was down on the roster but not a star. But then once everything hit the fan and they got desperate, now it was let's crack down on the Saquon Barkleys and the stars of the world and try to make it consistent. And by that point, there was nothing established. There was no foundation of we treat everybody the same here. You know, I think fans probably get tired of hearing cliches like, this coach treats everyone the same, you know, and sometimes right. It probably is a cliche and it's not genuine, but it doesn't always happen. And so with Judge, it appears he is being more consistent, I would say, than the previous staffs.
And, you know, on the flip side, you look at Gettleman, and granted, he's been here a few years now and, you know, certainly has not had the wins to necessarily justify him being around a much, much longer than, you know, the time he has here now. But you figure Judge's stay is going to be here longer than Dave Gettleman, so you're not going to get rid of a guy after 1 year. Do you think Gettleman's job is on the line this upcoming season? Whereas, you know, if the Giants, let's say, go 4-12, 5-11, you're going to give Judge at least another year or two, but is Gettleman going to be able to survive that, Pat?
I think his job is on the line. And I, frankly, personally, I think this will be his last year as GM either way. If you remember, before he drafted Daniel Jones, he spoke a lot about how if he could just find the Giants franchise QB and get them set up for the future, he would happily retire to Cape Cod. And, whether this season goes off the rails and they lose a ton of games again and he gets fired for, the fact that the team isn't any good, or if they start to show some promise, Jones takes the next step. The Giants look like they have a foundation in place. Judge takes more charge. And Dave maybe, slips off into the sunset saying, like, this is what I came to do and this is what I did. It wouldn't surprise me if either of those scenarios happened. I think one of them is likely, if not the other. Frankly, it's going to be very difficult to win a lot of games this year with this roster, even though it looks like they have a long-term plan in place. But you mentioned Daniel, you mentioned Gettleman, and that I always come back to Daniel Jones with him too, because really he's made a lot of mistakes as a general manager. But if he got the quarterback right, that'll go a long way. And so how Jones plays this year, even though it's a new offense, even though it's a new head coach, that'll go a long way to kind of defining whether Gettleman even has the decision or the choice to stick around.
Oh, his legacy totally is tied to Daniel Jones. I mean, much like Ernie Accorsi's was with Eli Manning. And certainly, Ernie Accorsi had stepped down, when they finally won that first of the two Super Bowls. But, that was still very much Ernie Accorsi's pick here. And, Gettleman, he gave you Daniel Jones, Saquon Barkley, Andrew Thomas. And I heard him say, if the quarterback, the running back, a franchise left tackle, if you were able to provide those three things, that's a step in the right direction. Now, Daniel Jones, we know he hit the weight room in the offseason, got a little bit stronger, and, now that he knows what to expect going into his second year in the NFL, obviously the turnovers have gotten a lot of talk about what he needs to clean up from year number one. What are your impressions of Daniel Jones in his second training camp versus what you saw last year as a rookie?
Yeah, you're right. Physically, he looks bigger, he looks stronger. I know for a fact, now that I've covered him this long, for over a year, I know from talking to enough people and doing enough work behind the scenes that, like, he has franchise quarterback mindset and work ethic and qualities. Like, there's no question about it. As far as, like, when you talk to people who play with him and work with him and know him better than we do, you'll find very few people who don't 100% believe he's the real deal as far as, like, his makeup. But the missing part, as you're alluding to, is just kind of putting it all together on the field, translating it into wins, taking care of the ball. I don't want to overreact to his training camp, and he did have a really good practice late in camp. But the fact of the matter is, I watched him all 16 practices and scrimmages, and he seemed to have the same sort of indecision, the same tendency to turn the ball over or make a mistake that would compromise maybe the play before that was just an amazingly accurate deep pass, for example, looked similar basically to what he did last year. Now, he's still young. We can't just say, his camp wasn't over the moon, so he's not it. But the fact is, Jones said it, and actually I was glad that John Mara said it, because this is something I've written a lot, but I think people sometimes need a guy like John Mara to say it, which is, we think Daniel has the capability to be our guy, but he needs to take the next step. And I really think that that is not only the fairest way to say it, but that's exactly where he is, and that's where he is in the organization's eyes. They believe in him, but they need to see him get better. Last year was a good sign of things to possibly come, but it needs to get better than he was last season.
Talking Giants with Pat Leonard here on 98.7 ESPN. You talk about Daniel Jones, Pat, needing to take a step forward. Saquon Barkley is almost the opposite. You want to see him take a step back. And what I mean by that is you want to see rookie Saquon Barkley as opposed to the guy you saw last season. Now, I know that he was banged up a little bit and missed some time, but, we questioned if that burst and that explosion was there at times last season. Are they confident that you are going to see the guy who just burst onto the scene and was one of the best backs in football year number one?
Yeah, they do seem confident. He seems healthy. For every player this season, I would caution, and I know the NFL's talked about it and Judge and other coaches have talked about, you know, there is a concern this year that without the in-person workouts in the spring, that guys are not in the same kind of football shape. And so there will be, not just with Barkley, but everybody, there's a lot that's going to go into maintaining their bodies, especially somebody who gets the kind of workload that Barkley's going to get with the Giants to keep him fresh. So that will be certainly something to watch. But we all know what Jason Garrett's offense, even though he wasn't calling plays, looked like in Dallas as far as featuring Ezekiel Elliott and everything moved from there. You can expect that with Saquon. I would say maybe to keep him fresh and also to hide his one glaring weakness, which is pass protection. Deion Lewis, the veteran running back, he looks like he's going to be a significant factor in this offense for all you fantasy players out there. But I think that you're going to see Deion Lewis spell him at strategic points on passing downs. Maybe when they're behind, you might see both of them on the field at the same time, not necessarily taking Barkley out of the game. But certainly maybe somebody who they can rely on more in pass pro, who's also a good receiver, and give the Giants another option.
Giant fans probably remember Deion Lewis from his early days with the Philadelphia Eagles, but you're right. He's a dangerous player, can help out in the passing game as well. And you forget about, you know, you mentioned Jason Garrett, and I know Giant fans and a lot of us sit there and make fun of him, you know, with the clapping and when he was the coach of the Dallas Cowboys and whatnot. But let's not forget, before he was the head coach, he was a successful offensive coordinator. He got those units to perform at a high level. And, you know, I think a lot of what Daniel Jones and this unit could do this year, they have faith that Jason Garrett's going to be able to bring it out of them, no?
Yeah, no, they do. This is a huge element and story this season, Dan, and I'm glad you brought it up because it's almost like, you know, even Garrett is trying to tell us that we can't ask him about his Dallas days and how it ended and all of this, but he's such an important person to not only this team, but in the context of how this came together and how it could come apart if he wants to go be a head coach somewhere else. If his audition this season goes well, where does he end up next year? You know, does he really stay here if he shows that he can call plays and run an offense again? Or does he end up being a head coach somewhere else? Conversely, if it goes terribly this year, is he out after just 1 year? He was, remember, someone the Giants were going to interview for their head coaching job. But Jerry dragged out his exit from Dallas, and then they interviewed Judge and hired him before Garrett ever got an interview. So that's an interesting dynamic to watch. You know, a guy who could have been the head coach now working under a much younger head coach in the 38-year-old Judge. But yes, the premise of your question is right on point, which is that they have confidence that Garrett can bring the best out of Jones and the offense. It will be interesting to see, because this is not just the Giants, but other teams too. You have to kind of keep things simple enough early because of the abridged training camp and no preseason, so that things are moving at high speed and guys aren't overloaded with the playbook. But does that make things too vanilla out of the gate? You know, I don't know the answer to that yet. I do know Barkley will be featured heavily, and I can tell you that Evan Engram, if he stays healthy and this offense goes well at all, is going to have a monster year.
Big if, right? That's always been the question with Engram. Get on the field, stay on the field. Last thing on the defense. We know that they're hurting at the cornerback position. The secondary bears watching. Linebacker core kind of leaves a lot to be desired as well. Defensively, do they have enough playmakers to be effective?
I mean, the short answer to that, Dan, unfortunately, is no.
No.
But you could, you know, if Lorenzo Carter turns into the player that he was in the scrimmage last week as an edge rusher, and if Blake Martinez, who's dealing with some sort of injury right now, if he stays healthy and he's the player they signed him to be in free agency, if Bradbury can be a lockdown corner on the outside, there's a lot of ifs, you know, but they do have some guys who can make plays in spurts. Like Peppers, every once in a while, can make a big play. He's versatile. Logan Ryan, adding him late at such a cheap deal, was a big win, and really they're fortunate because losing McKinney, that was a player they really thought could be extremely valuable for them as a ball hawk. They're going to have to patchwork it, though, Dan, and I know that was kind of exactly what you were getting at, is that there's some pieces there, but unless Leonard Williams becomes a new player, takes the next step, Lorenzo Carter, all these guys down the line, and you mentioned the outside corner spot, they make the trade for Isaac Yiadom from the Denver Broncos for a 7th-round pick. I would expect him to be the starter there right away if not right away, then replacing Ballantyne halfway through the first game, because they can't start Corey there, unfortunately. So they're going to be searching. And this is why, Dan, fans should know that the 53-man roster that came down on Saturday is nothing close to final.
No.
Because they are constantly churning this roster because it's not good enough.
Absolutely, and you're going to see every GM in the NFL do that over the next couple of days here, too, to get things ready for next weekend. Pat, always appreciate a couple of minutes, my friend. Enjoy the season. I'm sure we'll be catching up soon, pal. Thanks for a couple.
You got it. Thanks for having me on, Dan. See you, man.
All right, Pat Leonard of the New York Daily News. Start to get some answers to all these Giants questions a week from tomorrow as they open up the season against the Pittsburgh Steelers. It's the final countdown. Final hour here on a Sunday morning. It's Dan Grosso with you on 98.7 ESPN. Hope you're having a great start to your day, enjoying this awesome Labor Day weekend. Isn't the weather great? You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Grosso, G-R-A-C-A. And Nikki played the final countdown. Why is it the final countdown? Because right now, as we're talking, as you are hearing my voice, okay, 2 minutes after 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, it is exactly 1 week from now, at this time, that Greg Buddle and myself will sign on to the air for Jets countdown to kickoff week one against the Buffalo Bills. And it can't get here soon enough, especially with everything that we've been through over the last several months. So very much looking forward to that. Just a week from now, we have ourselves some real football. We've talked a lot of Jets and Giants over the course of the program this morning. The Islanders, of course, were our big lead story here. Is congrats to the Isles, their fans. You're one of four left. And game one of the Eastern Conference Finals against Tampa Bay Lightning tomorrow night. You can hear it on 98.7 ESPN with coverage beginning at 7:30. Yankees fall again last night in Baltimore. Gerrit Cole was good early, but overall left a lot to be desired as far as I'm concerned. Mets get a win in Philadelphia last night. You get DeGrom on the bump today against the Phils, against their ace Aaron Nola. So hopefully they can get Jake some runs, get him another win. And DeGrom coming off his first loss of the season, where he had the one bad inning against the Marlins last Monday. He was done in by some shoddy defense by Pete Alonso, and the Mets were unable to bail him out there. So that's what the baseball story is looking like this afternoon. Tanaka goes for the Yankees. And as I said, we're a week away from football, which is certainly a good sign of things to come. Let us say hi to Bruce. He's in Flushing. He's up next here on 98.7 ESPN. Bruce, good morning. What's up?
Good morning, Dan. Two Giant points and a Yankee point, if I can.
You're
first
sure.
On the Giants, why did they cut Ryan Connolly? If he wasn't fully recovered from the surgery, you could have put him on injured reserve. When healthy, he was a damn good linebacker, and he seemed to be a type of player Joe Judge would like. So explain to me why they cut Ryan Connolly.
I was surprised by that one. And Connolly, of course, you know, you could make the question, Bruce, like, well, why are you cutting this guy if he was, let's say, somebody else's draft choice, right? But he was Dave Gettleman's pick a year ago here. So, and he got himself some playing time last season. I think when push comes to shove, it's a couple of things. Number one, like you said, wasn't 100%. If you dig a little bit deeper, was not exactly graded out all that highly by the Pro Football Focuses of the world. And I think that they had a greater need at some of these other positions. And he probably got caught in a numbers game more than anything else. We'll see that, you know, we'll see if he gets claimed by some other team here over the next day or so.
Second point. To me, the difference in this Giant team than in the last couple of years, it will be discipline. There'll be more discipline on the field, because that's what Joe Judge demands. And I think watching the games last year, where you saw receivers open, wide open, 20, 30 yards wide open, maybe it may happen once, but it's not going to happen more than once, because Judge will either fix it or bench the guys who are supposed to be covering the guys.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds good, Bruce, right? I mean, in theory, and I thank you very much here for your phone call, it's... But the thing is, the player's still got to go out there and make plays. You know, when you look at the Giants right now, you're asking me, they still have some significant holes. I mean, Pat alluded to it as well, and I'm talking about the defensive side of the ball. Offensively, look, if they could stay healthy, I think they're going to score some points this year. You know, I think the offensive line's going to be – I love Andrew Thomas. Love Andrew Thomas. You know, I think the Giants, by picking him as the first tackle off the board, you know, they did a good job. And now he's going to be thrown right into the fire at left tackle with Solder opting out. And look, Andrew Thomas, I think, is going to be a better player than Nate Solder. So you got your best guy where he needs to be. Pat mentioned Evan Engram. Guy's got to stay healthy. Stay on the field. They've got receivers. Barkley will have a bounce-back season. And, you know, the pieces around Daniel Jones should be there for him to take that next step. Defensively, though, you have questions, right? There's a lot of question marks. You know, are the corners going to be good enough? You know, they give a lot of money to James Bradbury. Is James Bradbury a number one lockdown corner in the NFL? I don't think so. You know, but I know you could scheme around those things. You know, Jabril Peppers, is he going to be able to develop into a proven impact player that they were hoping they were getting when they made the Odell trade with Cleveland? He's got to make some plays. Logan Ryan is, you know, Logan Ryan's a nice player, but I don't think he's a difference maker. And they're going to line him up all over, you know, play in the slot, he'll play deep, he'll play, you know, he's not a shutdown corner by any stretch. He even said he considers himself more of a safety. He's more of a hybrid than anything else. You know, and then they invested a lot in Leonard Williams still, but Leonard Williams is what Leonard Williams is. He's good against the run. He's not going to be a big sack guy. You know, he'll have his, you know, 1.5, 2 sacks or whatever it is, and his tackle for loss. He's going to talk about all the double teams that he absorbs. And, you know, look, I lived it for years when he was with the Jets. That's who he is. Dexter Lawrence hopefully develops into that difference maker on that defensive line, a guy who's going to be disruptive in the opposing backfield. That's what the Giants need more than anything else. And they have some challenges right out of the gate here, whether you think that this team is going to be competitive or not. But look at the first half of the season, first 8 games. Steelers, then at Chicago, home 49ers, at Rams, at Cowboys, home Washington, at Philadelphia, home Tampa Bay. Not easy. Not easy. I think if you're a Giant fan right now, you'd sign up for 3 wins out of those first 8. You take 3. Just so you don't bury yourself in the first part of the schedule. And the schedule is nothing more than just a document you see on paper. Meaning, you don't know how these teams are going to be. Like, it cracks me up when everybody sits there and talks about strength of schedule. And this strength of schedule is a figure based on the performances of these teams from a year ago. So what good is that going to do you in 2020? You know, every single year we talk about games before they happen, about teams that look difficult. It looks like that could be a tough game because that's how they were last year. But you don't know if they're going to be good this season. And teams that you might think are a little bit of a layup, like a lot are probably doing when they see the Giants on their schedule. Well, what if the Giants are good this year? And then that game isn't easy, and vice versa. So I think it all comes back to it's a new season. You know, the NFL, more so than any of these other sports, parity reigns supreme. You should believe that your team has a chance, even if you're a fan of one of the locals here in New York. I know that on paper, maybe things aren't all too optimistic, but you got to play the games. You got to go out there and, you know, you got to see what happens. Stay healthy, though, more than anything else. And you know, one thing, too, with this upcoming season, I should bring this up. A lot could happen between now and the end of the year. I get it. But at least to start, you're going to have a few teams that are going to be able to welcome fans into the stadiums. And I do think that that could make some sort of a difference. It could provide some sort of a home field advantage. And I don't think it's fair that the NFL left it up to each of the 32 teams to be the ones to decide, in conjunction, of course, with their local governments, what is going to be allowed. I think the NFL should have made one rule for all the teams. Because I think really where the unfair advantage comes into play is when you're talking about division opponents. Like, take the Giants case. They're not going to be able to have home games when they play the Dallas, or they're not going to be able to have fans at home games. So, for instance, when the Dallas Cowboys come in, there's going to be no fans in the stands. And in a lot of years, it's been a lot of Cowboy fans. But when the Giants go down to Dallas, not only are they going to be a road team, you're going to have fans in the stands. Not a packed house, but at least some.
And that could change certainly as we move forward through the season. Like, there's a lot of clubs that have said, we're not going to have fans for the first two home games. We're not going to be able to welcome in fans at least until October. And right now, who the heck knows if the Jets and Giants are going to have any fans at all throughout the course of the season, even though here in our area, we've done a nice job flattening that curve and dealing with the virus. You know, could we completely 100% rule out the possibility of fans? No, but am I optimistic? Probably not. You know, that we're going to be able to see anybody at MetLife Stadium before all is said and done. You wish that was the case, but not happening. Sal's in Dutchess. He's up next here on 98.7. Sal, what's going on?
Hey, good afternoon. Oh, good morning still. Quick question. I know it might sound crazy or whatever, but with the Chiefs and the Ravens both being at 25-1 odds, and it seems like it's possible because the last team who went on the regular season was the Patriots. Mm-hmm. Do you think they either one could go 16? Both of them definitely can't do it, go 16-0.
No, I don't think. I don't think that's happening. No, I don't think either one is.
The Chiefs has a chance to go 16-0 because they play the AFC East and they play the NFC South.
Yeah, but Sal, I don't think it's going to happen. And a lot of it is what I just got done saying, and I thank you for the phone call. Too much parity in this league. Too much parity, and we don't know what to expect. You know, the one variable which is going to be hovering over this entire season, you know, when we talk about staying healthy, that's just in terms of football injuries and the physical aspect of this. The virus is still going to be hovering around everything here. And what's to say that a player or several players even from one position group, for example, are not going to be ravaged potentially by this virus at some point this season? What happens, you know, what happens if, forget about the quarterback position, which is the most important position in all of sports. What if a starting quarterback wakes up the day of the game and finds out he's got a positive test and he can't play? Whether that's Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson in this case, what Sal was alluding to with those teams. Then what? That's why some of these teams are talking about the possibility of like keeping a quarterback quarantined like throughout the entire week so they know that he can play regardless if something should crop up. Now, look, the NFL's done a phenomenal job here with the testing. There's like next to nothing as far as positive tests are concerned, but now teams are going to be traveling. Now teams are going to be, or players are going to be left on their own a little bit more. It's going to be incumbent upon themselves to do what's right, to act responsibly. You know, baseball seems to finally have gotten the hang of this thing. Now football's going to do the same, but it's hard to go undefeated. You know, that's why not too many teams have done it. And even the Patriots that did it in 07, they couldn't cap it off with a Super Bowl championship. But no, I don't see any team going 16-0 in the regular season this year. Dan Gross at 98.7 ESPN, taking it till the top of the hour here on this Sunday morning. A lot happening in the NBA this past week, specifically with the Brooklyn Nets and their new head coach. Talk about it all. Bring in the basketball insider extraordinaire for SNY. You could check out his web series called The Putback on SNY.TV. It's my pal Ian Begley. Ian, how are you, my friend? Thanks for hopping on.
Hey, Dan, how you doing, buddy?
Good. Thanks for hopping on, my friend, as always. How stunned are you that Steve Nash is the new coach of the Brooklyn Nets?
I was stunned. A lot of people around the league were stunned. Even people who knew Steve Nash well were stunned. A couple of people heard the news a few days before the announcement. And they were stunned. And so not a lot of people saw this coming. Credit to the Brooklyn Nets and people around Steve Nash for keeping it quiet. You know, I think one of the keys here for the Nets was obviously you're looking for somebody to coach Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. Because if those guys are falling in line and are on board with the head coach, everything else falls into place. And the Nets determined that Steve Nash was that guy. Obviously, it's a risky move. No coaching experience for Nash. But there are reasons to think that it could work there because of, you know, Nash's, what he's bringing to the table as far as his Hall of Fame pedigree. Players will respect him, his relationship with Durant. But yes, to answer your question, I was stunned. A lot of people around the league were stunned.
No doubt about that, because, oh, I mean, if they were going to make a big splash, all the rumors we heard was about, you know, possibly Greg Popovich maybe making the move to Brooklyn, but that never materialized here. So, naturally, we look at a guy with no coaching experience, Hall of Fame point guard. Boy, the Brooklyn Nets went down that road some years ago with Jason Kidd. Why is this going to be different, you think?
You know, I think part of the reason why this is different is because of the relationship that Nash and Kevin Durant already have. They've already established a close bond when, during Nash's time with the Warriors, he was a consultant, and he worked closely with Durant and with other players on the Warriors. But Durant specifically, they really established a strong relationship. So if you're coming into a job, whether you have a million years of experience or no experience, but you have already the confidence of one of the stars on your roster, that bodes well for you. Because usually, star buys in, top guy buys in, everybody else on the roster falls in line. So I think that's one reason where you point to where you say this could be different than, let's say, a Jason Kidd scenario, a Derek Fisher scenario.
Now, do you think that this bodes well for Steve Nash, given the fact that, you know, he doesn't have the experience, and now he's inheriting a team, Ian, that by all accounts is a win-now team? It's different if you don't have experience and maybe you get to grow on the job with maybe a developing roster and the expectations aren't this high. Do you think this works in Steve Nash's favor, that he's expected to win and win big with this team right out of the gate?
No, not at all, because it would be difficult for a coach with no experience to take that seat with a team that was rebuilding. It would be really tough to learn things on the fly, to get acclimated to being a head coach at the top level of basketball. It makes it even more tough if you're dealing with a team with championship expectations, because you don't really have room for error. There's such a little margin for error for everybody in that organization, particularly that coach. So it makes it an even bigger risk for the Nets, given where they are, given this tight window that they have with Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving. It's championship or bust. So that just makes it all the more interesting and all the more risky, in my mind, when you talk about the move the Nets made last week.
Talking basketball with Ian Begley, SNY. Check out his web series, The Putback, on SNY.tv. Overall, now the Knicks coaching staff is settled, Ian. What do you think about the way Leon Rose and company structured the staff here for the new coach?
The thing that interests me is, you know, so many different coaches who have come through New York over the past 10, 15 years have talked about player development, right? Player development, that's all we hear. And then you fast forward a couple of years into that coach's tenure, and the Knicks never have many success stories to tell when it comes to player development. Here, with Tom Thibodeau, they've hired Johnny Bryant, an assistant coach in Utah, who has a very, very stellar reputation as a player development coach. They've hired Kenny Payne from Kentucky, again, stellar record as a player development coach. So they've spent a lot of money to hire these two guys who have strong reputations in that area of player development where they've lacked and lagged for so long. So that's what interests me about this staff, is the idea you bring those two guys in. Do they get the results here under the Thibodeau Leon Rose regime with player development that we haven't seen in the past? That's the thing I'm looking at. And you have Mike Whitson, a guy who has won here, one of the only coaches to win here really in the last decades, and he brings a wealth of experience to that bench that he can help Tom Thibodeau navigate maybe some things within the organization, outside of the organization, that he will come across, because Woodson has been through that and succeeded through that. And, you know, to go back to Brooklyn for a second, to me it's so key for the Nets who they bring on Steve Nash's staff in addition to Jacques Vaughn, because you need, I think, a veteran staff, a staff that has experience coaching at the highest level to help him navigate the things that he's going to see over the course of his first season as head coach.
And that's the thing, too, and I want to continue more on the Knicks, but let me go back to Brooklyn for a second, because you brought it up with the staff. Jacques Vaughn did a great job, but now we find out he realistically didn't have a shot to become the head coach, because this decision with Nash was made up a couple of months ago, which is unfair to Vaughn, given what he had to deal with down there in the bubble, but did a great job, all things considered. I think back to Jason Kidd. You know, we keep using this parallel here, but Jason Kidd, when he was the head coach, he wasn't sitting there during timeouts, Ian, and drawing up plays on the board there with the X's and O's. He always had an assistant doing it. Is that probably the way things are going to go for Steve Nash? It's going to be somebody else, and he's going to almost be like that CEO overseeing everything?
That to me would make sense. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly how it's going to play out, but something like that would make sense to me. Because I think, you know, Steve Kerr, for example, I think one of the things that he had to get used to year one was, you know, managing a game. The X's and O's, the game manager, substitution patterns, play calls, this and that. So maybe you do see that with Steve Kerr. I'm not familiar with that timeline. I think Jacques Vaughn actually did have a shot. Like, let's say they weren't able to get a deal done with Steve, which I don't think this was in place months ago. But let's say they weren't able to get a deal done with Steve. I think Jacques Vaughn would have had a shot. But I do think that having him on as your top assistant coach is big, because he's got a relationship with these players that are going to be coming back to you next season. And he has a lot of experience in the organization. He's been an assistant coach in Brooklyn for several years. So having somebody like that with the corporate knowledge is only going to help Steve Nash. Whether he succeeds or fails, we'll find out. But I think having Zach Vaughn in that seat is big for them.
All right, let me be cynical here for a second. You talk about the relationship that Steve Nash has with Kevin Durant, and I get all that stuff. But when Kevin Durant signed with the Brooklyn Nets last summer, one of the things that he pointed to as a reason was how fond he was of Kenny Atkinson and how he became such a nerd for Kenny Atkinson's basketball acumen. He'd go on YouTube and watch all of these clips and, you know, from an X's and O's standpoint. So he thought that Kenny Atkinson was one of these great coaches, and then Kenny Atkinson got the boot. How do we know that the relationship isn't going to go sour with KD and Steve Nash?
It's a great question. I think there's a big difference between working out with a player and advising a player in a consultant role, as Steve Nash did with the Warriors, and coaching a player, being able to be brutally honest with a player, as Steve Nash is going to be in the head coaching role, you know, in difficult moments over the course of the season. So that's a big difference. But I think one thing here is, you know, Kenny Atkinson, you talked about it. Kevin Durant was watching him on YouTube and press conferences and whatever, and he liked him based on that. But it's different when you work with a guy and you're around him in the crucible of an NBA season. I don't think, you know, Durant, I'm not sure if he played a major role in what happened with Atkinson leaving, but obviously if Durant wanted him to stay, if Kyrie Irving wanted him to stay, he would have been there. But I do think that there's a difference, because this was a relationship with Nash and Durant that was built with sweat equity and a mutual respect and an understanding, and it was established in a big way before they will become head coach and superstar player. So I think that those roots were not there for Atkinson and Durant in the way they are there for Durant and Steve Nash.
All right, final thing, and let me get back to the Knicks here for a second. The last few years, it was all about rebuilding and branding this new culture and getting the right pieces in and having these young players and trying to develop them and to see them grow. And they were very patient, taking their time. I don't necessarily want to use the word tanking, but it didn't look like playoffs were of the urgency. I think we can all agree on that. Now you have a brand new coaching staff, new people in place. Do you see them, Ian, being active here in the offseason, trying to load up with some more veterans, perhaps to where they think they can make a run at maybe a 7 or an 8 seed next year in the Eastern Conference?
My guess is that having a veteran presence on this team, regardless of what happens with the young core, will be important. You know, I don't know specifically if you're getting veterans to take minutes away from the young guys, or if you're getting veterans to send in and bench and be good locker rest. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was the former. You're getting a couple of vets to play heavy minutes, because I think, just my guess, part of what they want to establish with the winning culture is actually winning some games. And the importance of the feeling and the experience of playing winning basketball. So I wouldn't be surprised if they kick the tires on some veterans like that that could come in, have a bigger role, help you win some games, as opposed to, you know, having young guys roll the ball out and having the young guys play 40 minutes a night and taking your lumps and winning 17 games and tons of a jet. I think it'll be more the former than the latter. That's just my read on things at the moment. But I do think that when you look at the Knicks, you know, so many times in the recent past, they've been all in on free agency, as we saw in 2019. They've been all in on the draft. Now I think you have the tools in play to do both. You could be, you're all in on the draft. You could build through the draft. You could try in free agency, but if it doesn't work out, if you don't get that guy, you don't put yourself behind the eight ball as they did last summer, you can try to snag somebody in a trade, and if it doesn't work out, you can continue to be patient. So I think one difference here is they have different avenues available to them, whereas past regimes maybe put all their eggs in one basket and things didn't end up well.
Well, start to get our answers soon, definitely. Ian, thanks for a couple of minutes, my friend, as always. Always good to catch up, and stay safe, and we'll talk again soon.
Likewise, Dan. Take care, buddy. Talk to you soon.
All right, you'll be good. Ian Begley, SNY's Basketball Insider. You could check out the Putback, his new web series on SNY.tv. That's pretty much going to be it for us this morning. Want to thank Ian Begley and Pat Leonard. Want to thank Giselle Hernandez and Nikki Hartman for producing the show. And guys, it's here. It's happening. 1 week from today, I'll talk to you on Jets Countdown to Kickoff, Jets-Bills coverage, 11 a.m. next Sunday morning. It's been a pleasure. I'll catch up with you soon. Dan Gross is saying enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend here on 98.7 ESPN.